Hi, you're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, and it is the 3rd of May 2012 in Sydney, Australia. Welcome wherever you are, whether you're in the east of the Pacific or the west of the Pacific or somewhere else on this globe, or whether you're tuning in from another planet or indeed a different galaxy. We welcome your presence, and it is great to be able to have a discussion and for you to listen. And we do encourage our listeners to call in to the show, to the Logos Radio Network, and we have some numbers there that I'll be providing to you shortly. My name is Herewood Fenton. Truth News Australia is an Australian production, and it's been going for about 4 years now, actually. And we recently started broadcasting live on the Logos Network, reaching out to people across a number of cities in the US. And I'd like to welcome now to the show for the next hour our regular commentator, Josh Jackson, who's going to be providing some interesting talking points and some discussion for us. Welcome, Josh, to another show.
G'day, folks. How are you? I'm actually coming in from another dimension. Or another galaxy, as you stated in the...
which galaxy are you coming from?
Well, it's galaxy of South Australia here, actually.
Right, yeah, well, but I do believe they have some unusual customs and laws over there.
There's a few little extra bits and bobs you get for living down in South Australia. For instance, not that I smoke it these days, but they had the pots decriminalized down here.
Oh, that is interesting, isn't it? So that law, which was brought in South Australia, I believe, quite a long time ago, is still in effect, that it's actually not a criminal offence to have a bit of the hooch.
Yeah, well, it's not a criminal offence to grow it, although the police will still come and take him all away. They'll come over to your house and they'll rip them all up and take it all away, but you won't get a criminal record.
I see. So they just sort of punish you with ordinances and make your life hell, but you don't actually get a criminal record.
Yeah, you give you a few taserings and run off with your stock. But
interesting.
Actually, the interesting story about that, it used to be in the 80s, you could have 8 plants or 9 plants and any size. So, of course, people were growing huge amounts. And over the years, it's gone down to 7, down to 6, down to 5. Now it's down to 1 plant only, you know, so high, like a meter high, you're allowed to have. And so everyone's growing this 1 plant, a meter high, but really long.
Really?
You see these pictures of people that have grown these plants that are really, really long, but, you know, go out in the horizontal.
So they actually train the plant to kind of grow like a vine.
Yeah, so, you know, people just get around stuff. But
look, it is ridiculous. I mean, you know, all of these laws and statutes and things that are passed, I mean, there's just so many of them. And I mean, why can't we have a world where things are just managed reasonably? I mean, you did a show a couple of weeks ago with Stefan Molyneux where you guys stepped through some ideas about a world completely without government. And, yeah. You know, and I thought that was interesting. I would love to actually debate Stephen Molyneux at some time on some of those points, because, I mean, he's obviously very articulate and I know he has a great following on the internet. I actually think that we need a structure. You see, my approach to this, Josh, is that I take a very etymological and sort of linguistic view of language itself. And I say, well, you know, words that are in our language have a meaning. And a word that has a meaning in language has some purpose to exist. And so the word government, and, you know, we could actually go into that, and maybe, you know, would like to do a show where we actually analyze what is the meaning of that word. I think it has a legitimate meaning, you know, but the meanings have been corrupted. And it gets to the point where you start to think, well, is this whole concept, you know, even viable? Should we throw it out? But
it's also not only the meaning, but what characteristics do you give government, what powers do you give them? And generally what will happen is that the person will, the people of the state will constantly demand more, that the state gets more power on their behalf. And it's never really on their behalf. It's just more power on the state's behalf, which, and it's funny, the government as a concept. So when I say state folks, I don't mean a state. I mean,
you mean state as in the country,
an institution.
Institution,
of government. Yeah. So, you know, usually the state gets bigger and bigger, but it's always on the demand of the people to say, "Hey, we need free this and we need free that," and or you know, better this and better that. And really, all you're saying is, "Hey, we want to, you know, take more money from the middle class," because people forget that the government has no money.
Indeed,
you know, it doesn't make anything, doesn't produce anything.
Now, before we get too deep into that, which I'd love to just plunge right into that topic for the next hour, the point is I need to advise our listeners that we have, at the beginning of the next hour, a really important interview coming up with one of Australia's top scientists who is also a skeptic of the so-called consensus on climate change. Yes, yes, he's one of those terrible people they call denialists.
No, I mean, that word, I'd like, because again,
indeed,
deconstructing words is an interesting one, because let's look at where the concept of a denialist comes in. And for my money, I think the first time I heard it was with Holocaust denial.
Yeah, that'd be about right, I'd say, yeah.
I don't think I've heard it in many other places. So instantly you have this this throwback to something that's, I mean, you know, I mean, I know a few people who are sort of revisionists, I guess. They look at the history of what happened with World War II, and they don't believe the finer details. But generally, everyone realizes that what happened in Germany was pretty abhorrent. Very, very abhorrent. They killed you know, millions of people, innocent people. The state did for this ridiculous agenda of cleansing. But now to say that if you're a global warming skeptic, you're a denier. So it's quite a strong connotation towards the whole Holocaust denial.
Yeah, look, thanks for that reminder there, Josh. Now, the denialist that we're having today, I'm sorry to, I really am using that word in an ironic term. I find it abhorrent. Okay, but the scientist we are bringing on today is Bob Carter, Professor Bob Carter from the University of Townsville. He's a geologist with a huge experience history. He's been teaching at universities for something like 40 years. He's an extremely personable man. He's extremely engaging, and I've got some articles online that he's published, in which he goes through some of the chronicles that he's had as a climate skeptic in trying to get his voice heard. And, you know, Josh, it's just been incredible what he's been through. I mean, what this man's been put through. He continually gets invited to speak at conferences. And then at the last minute, sometimes after he's already arrived, at his own expense on a plane, right, they suddenly say, "Oh, I'm sorry, you can't speak." And this is because of this vast network of lobbyists that control the world's academic institutions and the government bodies and the IPCC. And quite often he will be invited in good faith by someone who thinks that we need to have this guy's opinion, right? And that will be a genuine offer, right? But what happens? The lobbyists get involved. And then suddenly there's probably a threat that the funding's going to be pulled. But even more typically what they do, and he describes this in his article that he wrote for Quadrant a couple of years ago, is that the mainstream scientists will then refuse to participate if they see he's on the list. And this is a particularly nasty tactic that they do, Josh, is that these IPCC scientists will look at who else is coming to a conference, and if they see, Bob Carter's there, they'll say, "I'm not going to speak because I'm not going to dignify him by, appearing on a podium where he's appeared."
But the interesting thing is they keep rabbiting on about this consensus. There's a consensus. Well, surely if there's one person, one scientist, one climate scientist who is against the common thread, then the whole consensus is gone. That's only one person. And I know of many, many, many people that are in the scientific field who have very large questions about the whole man-made global warming, man-made climate change debate. And so to constantly bring up this consensus and then say, oh, I'm not going to talk if there's someone that doesn't agree with this so-called consensus, they're not, you know what I mean? It's a ridiculous notion that there's a consensus.
It's a strange twist of the mind, isn't it? A strange mental doublethink that has to be engaged on to, on the one hand, say that there's this marvelous consensus, and on the other hand, have this incredibly hair-trigger sort of reaction to anyone who is a scientist, who is not part of the consensus.
Yeah, it's almost a forced consensus.
Yes, yes. It's we all agree or else.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Some animals... we're all equal, but some animals are more equal than others.
Now, maybe you've got an opinion about this. We would love to hear from you. If you think that there is a consensus and you think our view of the consensus is non-consensual, you are welcome to challenge us. And we've got two numbers, actually. We've got the US number, which is 512-646-1984. That's the number to call if you're in the United States. If you're in Australia, we have a 1300 number. That's our local call-in cost, 1300-153-372. So if you would like to have a chat with us, or if you would have some questions for Bob Carter in the next section of the show, you're welcome to call in. We would love to hear from you.
Absolutely. Yeah. So one thing that's in the news at the moment down here, down under.
Indeed.
Is house prices, folks. House prices have started to drop. Well, for the fourth quarter or exactly. Yeah, well, they're falling in every capital city. It's a small fall, but capital cities prices are down by 1.1%.
House prices fall for the fifth quarter and a rate cut looms.
Fifth quarter, that's the one I was looking for.
Yes, and I believe that the rate cut has been announced by some of the banks today. I've been listening to the news a bit. Look, when we come back from the break, let's break it all down. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free. Hi, welcome back. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia. My name's Hereward Fenton. It's great to have your company today with Josh Jackson, and we are discussing housing prices in Australia. And it turns out that we may be at the end of the bubble and at the beginning of a new slump. Josh, what's your take on the whole situation?
Well, I mean, we in Australia here have been... we've been constantly propped up by schemes, and the government calls them that. They call them schemes, and I also find that word quite interesting, because really I just sort of, a scheme to me sounds dodgy. I mean, doesn't it to you, Harold? Like if you hear of a scheme, you think, oh, you know, I don't want to be part of that. That sounds a bit
scheming. Well, it sounds dishonest.
Yeah, yeah, and really that's what it is, because what. what they've done in Australia to keep house prices propped up, when they start seeing a dip in house prices, they come out, the government did it a few times, where they release these grants for first home buyers, for home buyers that buy brand new homes, all these sort of things. And these are bubble proppers. I mean, I see them as bubble inflators, because as soon as you start seeing a little bit of a contraction in the house prices, instantly, oh, now you get $7,000 from the government if you buy a new house. At one stage, it was double that. It was $14,000 you got, you know. And so, you know, all that really happened was house prices went up by $14,000. Not straight away, and they weren't meant to, but of course the market just sucks in the that grant. So again, you're artificially inflating the property prices by $14,000, and so they've tried to cut that back slowly, like a heroin addict cutting back on his hit, but really they can't do anything about it. We are now so deep in the hole. Property prices in Sydney, folks, you literally, for $1 million, you get a shoebox. I mean, you can fit one foot in it and you have to cut a hole for your toe. It's obscene. It really is. And I don't know how the common folk, like teachers and nurses and as such, live, to be honest. I mean, I know a lot of people in their 40s hooking up in share apartments now, and they've got good, respectable jobs. But to survive in Sydney, to actually live, you have to live in these share houses. And there's reports of so many empty units because of the tax. And we've done a show on this before.
Yeah.
Back when we were just a podcast. But, you know, we've got places now that empty places everywhere because it's better for investors to have empty places while people are starving on the streets and homeless have empty houses there just because it's better for their tax. And, you know, you don't have any threat of anyone trashing your investment. So, you know, it's an investment rather than a roof for someone to live in.
Look,
it totally infuriates me. But and the mainstream press here, because everyone is invested in housing, everyone is invested. I mean, generally, you know, it's got to be every one of the baby boomers at least have got two or three houses, and you know, my generation have really, you know, so little people have really got been able to get into the housing market, and the generation Y is going to have no chance, but. You basically have this situation now where every bit of media and analysis of the housing market is twisted and turned because everyone writing these articles are so heavily invested in property, they'd never want to perpetuate any truths about a property collapse or overinflation. And so you have this problem where every bit of media has this spin. Even when you read stories about property prices going down, they're straight away, oh, the RBA's cut rates though now, so it's going to go back up, folks, and property price, and they have these straight, and you see on the ABC, who's meant to be nice and which is our government run station here in Australia, they're meant to have these even keeled debates, but when you get these debates, they're basically having these schizophrenic debates where they're saying, oh, how are we going to housing affordability? How are we going to have more affordable houses? And then on one side, they're saying, how can we have more affordable houses? And on the other side, they're saying, oh, but we can't have deflation in the property market. We've got to keep on going higher. So they really don't know what the heck they want. They really are having a twist in thinking because they're both juxtapositions. We've got to make houses more affordable, but ooh, we can't destroy the investment of all these baby boomers.
It's another just double contradiction. It's like we're just being pulled in two different directions, and in order for the economy to thrive, we have to have this continuous inflation, essentially. And the most
I bet that's biggest, That's a lie. I mean, not on your half, but that's what they're saying. Yeah, you've got to have this constant inflation. But the problem is, we're having this constant inflation. People aren't spending money. People aren't spending money, folks.
But that's why
their money into these mortgages and into rents, because as mortgages go higher, rents are going higher. I mean,
yes, correct.
I was renting in Sydney for a long time, and every year we'd move because all of the places that we were in. It's not that we were bad tenants; it was that they want to flip these properties,
so and they want to put the rent up.
The landlord would ring you up and say, "Hey, I'm selling, by the way."
Oh, okay.
And so you'd never know if you get another investor or someone that actually wants to move in. So to give yourself enough time to find a place, you'd rather move out than take the risk of hopefully they'll find another investor and I can stay here. Because
Absolutely.
If they find another seller, you have to be out in like 3 weeks.
Well, I think there are some protections for tenants now. I think that 60 days notice is a standard term. But look, I think that... The situation with the affordability of living, the affordability of accommodation, has really reached such ridiculous proportions now, because the average cost of an apartment is so high that it's such a huge proportion of what people's income is. And so people are forced to, you know, double up and do all these really, really ridiculous things in a country which is, you know, supposedly, you know, one of the highest standards of living in the world, and we've got a strong economy. We've got plenty of land.
Oh,
like there's no reason.
We've got land coming out of our ears.
Yeah, yeah. There's
really.
There's no reason for people to be putting such a massive amount of their income just into their living expense. But yes, I mean, this idea that the property investment is the driver of the economy is one that is just dragging everything down. And of course, it seems that it only gets worse. Like it's one of those problems that is not being addressed, because it seems to be a systemic problem. And I think we've got one of these deep systemic problems in the way our monetary system works, which, you know, we often have discussed on this show, and you know, we've all got our opinions on it. A lot of people have researched it and read books like Money is Debt and The Money Masters and films like that attempt to explain the underlying problem of the debt-based economy. And of course, for the domestic economy, the debt associated with a mortgage is the major part of the economy. That is how money gets into our economy. It is by purchasing property that then that money is issued as a loan. You know, without that, the economy wouldn't have money flowing into it. And
that's right.
And that's why it is such a disaster when the housing industry collapses, because it means that conduit of getting money into the economy is failing, and then you have massive deflation. Then the whole thing starts to fail. But you know, it's a badly designed system, which seems to also benefit the people at the top of the pyramid.
Well, yeah, it's only badly designed if you're participating in it from a consumer end. If you're a banker, or hold the right to print money, you're loving life.
Yeah, and you know, speaking of that, I should note that there's been a bit of a resurgence in the Occupy movement this week. There's been a number of reports. I might try to get those up in the next section, but. The Occupy movement again, you know, which purportedly is trying to address this imbalance in terms of the 1% who, you know, to me it's really the 0.001 of the 1%, but you know that banking elite essentially is at the top of the pyramid, and they are doing so much damage to us, exploiting us in a predatory way while bringing the whole system down.
But really, and we'll get to it after the break, but, you know, it's the leveraging of government that allows them to do that. It's the lobbying of government. It's the
Absolutely. We're just going to break now, Josh. We'll be right back after these few words.
I've hardly to my name. The heavens never seem so near, and all my body glows with flame. The tempest struggles in the air. Unto myself alone I sing. It could sink me then and there. I can hear the echo ring. I try to find one smiling face to drive the shadow from my head. I'm stranded in this nameless place, lying restless in a heavy bed. Tell me straight out, if you will, why must you torture me? Why must you come from your hand and throw my fate to the clouds and wind? Far away in a silent land, secret thoughts are hard to bear. Remember me, you'll understand. Emotions we can never share. You trampled on me as you passed, left the coldest kiss upon my brow. All my doubts and fears have gone at last. I've nothing more to tell you now. By tranquil lakes and streams, as each new season's dawn awaits, I lay awake at night with troubled dreams. The enemy is at the gates. Beneath the thunder of blasted trees,
hi, welcome back. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia. And we have a caller, Ted from Texas. Ted, you're welcome to speak.
You there, Ted?
Yes, are y'all there?
Yeah, hi, Ted. Hereward Fenton here from Truth News Radio Australia, here on the air with Josh Jackson. Great to be speaking to you today.
Thanks for taking my call. You know, Texas and Australia may have a few things in common. I don't know. We're full of empty spaces and full of things that poke and pinch and bite.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, that's true.
So what do you guys think, though? Here in Texas, we're undergoing a very bad drought. And, of course, you know, what do I know about Australia? Not much, but except what I've read in books and what I see in the media. And haven't y'all had some unusual climate events? Or maybe they're not unusual. Didn't Sydney have some bad dust storms? And haven't y'all had floods?
Well, you know, Ted, we actually had a really bad drought for many years until about 3 years ago. And, you know, the climate change alarmists were telling us at that time that the drought we were experiencing was proof of anthropogenic climate change, because that was part, you know, what they said the model was predicting. Then we suddenly moved into a new phase, and I think it's really the El Nino weather pattern across the Pacific, but the rain started, and then we started getting some massive floods, and we had The city of Brisbane completely flooded about 2 years ago, actually about a year and a half ago. We've had massive floods last year in Australia. But, you know, it's renowned in this country. I mean, there are poems and songs about it. It's known as a sunburned country, a land of droughts and flooding rains. That was one of our famous poets wrote that.
Yeah, years ago.
So, and also, what about the Great Barrier Reef? Is that showing signs of degradation or whatever? You know, I think the climate is slowly changing, but I don't know if they can blame it on my six-cylinder pickup truck or not.
Yeah.
So, well, that's the debate, right? And this is where it gets quite sneaky a lot of the time. I recently did a survey, on an online survey, and it basically the questions were so they were queried in a way that really made it difficult for me to answer. So the questions were like, is global warming happening? And of course I had to, or is climate change happening? Sorry. And I had to say, well, yeah, but that made my answer look like I just go along with everything. In the fact of the matter is, what I think is that climate change is always happening, but I just, exactly like you, I don't know if it's, you know, the pickup truck.
So how did the draconian climate change laws, or the carbon laws, or whatever you'd like to call them, how did they get passed in Australia? Did they get put to a public vote?
No.
Or...
Oh, Ted, look, that, you know, that is such an incredible story. And I spent a fair bit of time last week actually going through the key points. It's actually a story of betrayal. That's actually how it happened.
It's a story of betrayal.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And, it's amazing. It's amazing.
I mean, you go, Josh.
To give a quick wrap up, we voted in a prime minister. He got basically cut in the back by one of the cabinet members here, because we don't have a president over here, we have a prime minister. And the prime minister basically got stabbed in the back and chucked out, because he was trying to put through a mining tax. And of course the mining lobby then behind the scenes, this isn't exactly what's on the mainstream, but this is what I feel, really said, look, we need to get rid of this guy. We're not having a mining tax. Anyway, all of a sudden we wake up one morning with this new prime minister called Julia Gillard. And everyone's like, what? What happened to our prime minister? All of a sudden, we've got this new one. Okay, so everyone was up in arms about that. She decided to hold an election to make herself a bit more legitimate. They held an election, and the whole time she was promising in the election, there will be no carbon tax under my rule.
And that, of course, is because the previous prime minister had been trying to push one through, which was not used that name, but it was actually called an emissions trading scheme, very similar. It's just that it was not a fixed price, like the carbon tax is a fixed price on carbon. Kevin Rudd's scheme was an actual trading scheme. Now, of course, it was very unpopular. And as was the mining tax among certain parts of the business community as well. But Julia Gillard had made herself known to be against the carbon pollution reduction scheme.
During this election.
Yeah,
really, there would not be a carbon tax under my... I don't know if it's a rule or what she was saying. I'll probably not as...
Under a government I lead, she said.
Under the government I lead. And then, of course, she gets elected and boom, within a few months, we have to have a carbon tax. And so everyone's up in arms about that. And then she's passed it. So that's how.
Now, what's...
So much like some of the things Obama has, you know, things he's done here in America, in the way of broken promises and saying I'll do things and he hasn't done them, or I won't do things and he's turned around and done them.
So yeah. What's your perception over there, Ted, about the, you know, I mean, what are people thinking about the carbon dioxide issue and, you know, the idea that that we should put a price on carbon or create an emissions trading scheme? I mean, do you talk to people about this? Do you have a perception of what people think in Texas?
I can't say I talk to people about it, but the government in Texas is very conservative, and I don't think they would do anything like that.
Okay.
And at the state level in Texas, I cannot say about the national level. That's why I was wondering how it happened in Australia. It sounds like the people didn't have a voice in it. They didn't put it to a public vote. The same thing in America. I think if they put it to a public vote at this point in time in America, people would not go for it. So.
Yeah, and I mean, they've tried emissions trading schemes where they actually trade carbon over in Europe, and they collapse. They go down to nothing because generally you trade something that you actually want. You know, you buy what you want, and no one wants carbon dioxide. No. I mean, why would you want that? Maybe if you owned a greenhouse, you pump it in there, but really there's no point in buying something that that people don't want.
Technically, it's, you're not buying carbon dioxide, you're buying a permit to produce a certain amount of carbon dioxide. And as such, the permit is allowing you to do something which is regarded as bad. So it's like a permit to pollute. Although those of us who disagree with the science don't think it is pollution. But that's another story. But the concept of it is that you're selling these carbon credits, which is like your license to do something bad. And,
yeah,
you know, that as the basis for any type of economy is counterintuitive and it seems wrong. You don't want to be – that's not what the economy is based on. It's based on real commodities, you know, things that have a positive value, not a negative value.
Right. Like beer. That's a good Texas to Australia question. Do you guys like beer?
Do we like beer?
I do. I like a good naturally brewed beer. I'm not too keen on the some of the big beer breweries in Australia that put lots of additives in their beer. But I do like a nice naturally brewed beer. That's for sure.
That's good. It's funny, I've watched the evolution of Foster's. I remember Foster's, it was imported from Australia.
Yeah.
And the big breweries got a hold of it, and they started brewing it in Canada. But they, since it was in Canada, then they imported it into the United States. They could still say imported on the label. You had to read the fine print on the label to see where it's brewed.
Well, the funny thing is, you know, we can't buy Foster's here. They don't sell it. Foster's... Foster's
really?
Is not even I've never seen it in shops, I think, for probably 15, 20 years. You used to be able to buy it, but since it became a global thing, no, they don't even sell it here.
That's a misconception Americans would have of Australia. They think, well, everybody in Australia must drink Foster's because we don't know any better.
Yeah.
And now they've taken imported off the label, and if you read the fine print, it's brewed under license to Foster's by some – like Anheuser-Busch or somebody, some big brewery in America.
Look, it's just not one of the many ironies of this corporatist fascist system that we've got that allows this type of thing to go on. I mean, it's really, you know, in the case of Foster's, it's just silly. But, you know, it really does sort of bastardize the economy. It creates this completely false impression. That's what I think. It's one of the things we're engaged in a quest for truth here.
You know, another false impression thing, I don't know. In America, they've been on the major mainstream media, they've been pumping up this Osama bin Laden thing. You know, Obama went and got Osama.
Yeah.
And I am just totally uncomfortable with that.
And it really is amazing.
That they're really trumping that up.
Look, we've just got to go to break, guys. Look, it's been great talking to you, Ted. Sorry, we're just going to break now. Hopefully, we'll speak to you again soon. Thanks. Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. It is great to be talking to you today. For the top of the next hour, I have the renowned Australian climate skeptic Bob Carter coming on. He's a professor and he's scientist. He's actually, his expertise is in geology, but he's done a lot of work in climate and particularly paleoclimate. And he can actually clarify a lot of questions about the long-term history of the planet's temperature and CO2 levels, which a viewpoint that he has that doesn't get aired very much in the mainstream. So I'm really honoured to have Professor Carter on in the next hour. But in the next few minutes, I really want to discuss, I want to return to one of our most important topics that we cover here, which is the body scanners and the civil liberties aspects, the privacy aspects, the health and safety aspects of body scanners. And I want to kind of elaborate on that by looking at the whole kind of paraphernalia of what goes on in airports and indeed look at what airports really are. What is the purpose of an airport? It may seem like an obvious question, but I think it's really important when we start to see these extreme measures that are brought in supposedly to protect us from the bad guys, and that they're bringing them in airports, we really need to really then turn and look and say, well, what is an airport? So, Josh, I mean, look, you travel a lot, right? Now, I went overseas recently, and you know, one thing I noticed is that when you go through the immigration, after you've gone through immigration, you're heading towards the gate of your plane, you are absolutely bombarded by duty-free sales everywhere you go that are actually blocking your path. I mean, they've actually set up these barriers, so you're like a rat that has to weave through all these things, and it's hard to find the gate for your plane because of it. Now, have you noticed that?
Yeah. And one thing I've noticed, I was traveling back from Europe, and there was one time, this was amazing, Harold. They did all this, like ratted you through all these things.
Yeah.
And I didn't buy anything, but there was this woman, she'd bought like two bottles of whiskey or something like that.
Right.
And they'd all been wrapped up in these bags and everything that they do for security.
Yes.
Because, you know, God knows what you'll do with a whiskey.
Yes.
But basically, she got to her gate and they confiscated her because you're not allowed to bring the whiskey on the plane.
Really? After offering it to be bought in the departure area?
Yeah. Offering it in the departure area, sealed on this plastic bag so you can, you know, because you're not allowed to bring unsealed on the plane.
Yes.
But then you get to the gate and you're not allowed to bring sealed even on the plane.
So what's
the point in having these duty-free shops? I don't know. I guess to get the guards really drunk at the end of the day.
So her whiskey was taken and, I mean, was that it? I mean,
that was it. And now this is the nature of airports, right? and this is a good segue, is that airports, you're forced by nature of the expense and the excitement of going overseas or the need, that you have to go through their protocols. Because if you don't, well, you're just sitting duck. You have to stay there, right?
Absolutely. So,
like if you're using the bus and there's some hardcore, you know, you have to put your fingerprints at a face scanner to use a bus, well, then you'd go, oh, I'm going to use a taxi instead.
Right.
But with an airport, you got no choice. You have to fly. You have to move.
So, yes. And you know, in the wake of 9/11, and we have to, you know, have to be clear, this a lot of the ramp up of the security measures did occur in the wake of 9/11. They decided we're gonna make everyone safe at airports, you know, because that terrible event, those hijackers got onto those planes and flew them into buildings, and, you know, we must never let that happen again. And that, of course, does in a lot of people's minds justify it, I have to say.
Yeah, but, you know, all it takes is some lunatic or a false flag or something to happen at a library or at a bus shelter or anything else, and all of a sudden you'll see these scanners rolled out everywhere.
Indeed, and we're already seeing it. The London Olympics will be using body scanners. They're being used in courthouses in the US. They're also being used in prisons, I might add. So of course they will be rolled out. Now, the Target department store is using them in Sydney. Now, this
really?
Well, what, yes,
what,
indeed.
The X-ray scanner, back scanner machines?
The millimeter wave scanner. And to me, this looks like a PR stunt of the manufacturer of the scanner, because what they're using them for has nothing to do with what the machines were designed for. They're using them to measure people for fittings for clothes, right? But look, it's a joke. It's not genuine. The machines were not designed for that. Tailors aren't going to be using them, okay? I mean, it's not the way you measure someone for clothing. And it's not even necessary.
I've never heard of this. This is unreal.
It's ridiculous. And it's actually really annoying, okay, because it's just being used to make the machines look warm and fuzzy to people.
Yeah.
And of course, the people, the manufacturers of it, I think I'm sure they're offering the machine free to the department store as a stunt, as a PR stunt. I mean, these machines are expensive, right? They've got big contracts with our governments to sell them, and there needs to be a little bit of PR to help that along, and that's what this is. Mm-hmm. But look, I've got a news story here. I'll just quickly read to you. Brisbane Airport is bringing in the body scans. Passengers flying out of Brisbane International Airport will have to submit to full body scans or be banned from stepping on the plane. And this is from the Courier Mail. You know, I mean, I'm not lying to you here. This is seriously what they're doing. No opt out. Brisbane Airport Corporation is expecting to take delivery of the first of 8 body scanners in late August. That's quite a lot for a small airport like Brisbane. 8? That's incredible. The Brisbane Airport spokesperson said that at least 2 scanners will be operating by late September. But not everyone will go through them, Josh. So, you know, calm down. Okay? You're overreacting. Not every single person is going to be pushed through them. It will be a process of...
Not me, that's for sure.
It will be a process of random selection. So, you know, if you're chosen by the wisdom of the ballot, by the wisdom of the dipping the hand in the barrel, then I'm afraid you will have to go through it. And there will be no opt-out.
It'll be full of, you know, profiling people, and it'll be totally racist. And, you know, I mean, it'll... none of these measures, when they say it's random, are really random.
Now, Josh, the Queensland Council of Civil Liberties has opposed their use, calling the body scanners a virtual strip search. What do you say to that?
Well, I've been calling them a virtual strip search for a while, and I think people should be constantly referring to them as a virtual strip search, because that's what they are. Let's not beat around the bush, folks. They're a virtual strip search, and by muddy cuddling, by giving it these fluffy names like, a body scanner, really isn't what it is. It's a strip search, folks. They are looking underneath your clothes. They are stripping you virtually.
But Josh, I'm going to give you the PR spin now, okay?
Okay, spin me up.
The new machines that we have today, unlike the bad machines of old, right?
Yeah.
Are all absolutely shining, wonderful, kind, cuddly things, okay? Because they only present a stick figure version of the person in the scanner. So, Josh, all of your concerns are now allayed.
Because so they don't show the actual image. They just convert that to a stick image and highlight areas of concern. Is that right?
Yes. So all your privacy concerns, Josh, are now allayed.
Yeah. And this is why I think it's important that people attack the health concerns. I myself, I have, a pacemaker, and so I don't want to go through these strange machines. I don't care what they say. And so it's...
But Josh, there is no evidence that these machines are bad for you. Unlike the bad machines of old, the terrible machines that we used to have a few years ago, the new wonderful machines, the kind, cuddly, fluffy toy machines that they have now are utterly harmless. And
so is there any work in attacking this? Because I just feel, people, this is what it's about in airports, right, folks? In Asian countries, you have to put your thumb on when you come in through customs, you put your thumb on the little ink pad, but it's not an ink pad, it's a virtual one. It's an electronic one. It scans every one of your fingers, and it's like, okay, you can come through now. So again, you're in the country. You have to do it, otherwise you get sent back. So you've done your whole trip, you're tired, and if you don't do it well, you get sent back. So airports are a way of enforcing these these Orwellian tracking mechanisms onto everybody eventually. It's a slow rollout because eventually everyone, I mean, you know, I got to say, you know, 80 to 90% of people will travel at least once in their life, even if it's just interstate. But usually they'll go for a trip somewhere else, you know, up to Canada or over to Europe or wherever.
Can I just tell you about my feeling about airports, my experience, my, you know, mental feeling about airports, okay? Is that...
Lay it down.
Yeah, I've always disliked airports, going back many years. And I used to travel a lot when I was a kid because I had parents, I had a father who worked in a lot of different places and we used to travel a lot. Now, the thing about airports is they're very impersonal. They're very sort of depersonalizing. They're a little bit dehumanizing. And I think that's even in the best of cases, that's the way they are because it's just the nature of it, right? And I'm not saying that that's a terrible thing. I'm just saying I don't like it because of that, right? But there is something about it that once the bureaucracy of government gets a hold of this type of thing that starts to treat human beings like cattle, like livestock, they get carried away with it. Because it self-perpetuates this idea that we're going to just herd people and we're just going to get them to do this and get them to do that and force them all to do this. And of course, it's very easy because you're funneling them through and there's only one way they can get onto the plane. And then, of course, once you bring the security issue into it as an additional reason, then you can really ramp up the way you can treat people like cattle. And this is the point that we have to address, is that people are being treated like cattle. I came back recently via Malaysia. Every single person was getting a pat-down.
Yeah.
In fact, I didn't get one, but just about everyone. And that was after going through security. That was actually the gate getting onto the plane. Virtually everyone was getting a pat-down. And the Malaysian guards, I don't think they didn't even know why they were doing it. They were just probably told to do it. But it was obnoxious. It was offensive.
It's conditioning, folks. It's conditioning. And, you know, we have to go to a breakdown. It's about conditioning. It's important to stand up for your rights and say, look, and contact your congressman and say, the economy's going
to... We are going to break imminently. We'll be right back with Truth News Radio Australia.